Good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M Press, and he has authored over 70 publications on birds. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. Cliff, thanks for joining us once again.
Well, it's good to be in air-conditioned environments,
yeah,
right?
So I'm wondering, you know, are the birds roasting out there, or are they just like, hey, this is just wonderful for us?
Well, they're probably envious.
Yeah, okay. That's why they keep pecking at the door saying,
right.
Let us in. Yeah.
Yep.
So, well, at the end of last month's program, Cliff gave us a conservation tip, and we're going to refresh your memories about that, and then we'll carry on with the program. But while he's doing that, you can get ready to call in at 800-552-8502. That's the number to call in tonight with any question about birds. 800-552-8502, and we'll get those on next month. So, Cliff, what was our conservation tip last month?
As we end every episode with a conservation tip, just to, you know, end with that last moment of the show to kind of put something in your head to think about, we ended last one with native grasses. I challenged people to think of, you know, real quick, what would be the I challenge biologists and ecologists, what do they think would be the most altered or degraded habitat in North America? And most would say wetlands, and you know, a lot of them would be correct, but we often forget about the other extreme, the high, dry grasslands, and those areas that are rich with a diversity of grasses and forbs. And you can drive through the whole country and see lots of green pastures, and you think, well, what's he talking about? There's a lot of grasses. Well, if it's all pretty much one level, one height level of grass, it's probably carpet grass, thus non-native, and it's not good for our native birds. And grassland birds as a whole in this continent are hurting the worst, more than any other habitat type. So that's, you know, lots of quail and prairie grouse and several raptors and lots of sparrows and longspurs. And so we need to try to get more native grasses back if we want these species, like in our area, northern bobwhite and Bachman sparrow and several other species. If we want those back, we need native grasses, things like little blue stem, big blue stem, Indian grass, and switchgrass. These are the species of grasses that have bare ground usually around them, and that's the runway for a lot of these birds. They don't really like to be on top of carpet grasses like Bermuda grass, and that's why we've seen big eradication or extirpation of things like bobwhite. They just don't like to be on stage, so to speak. They like to hide in and amongst the bunch grasses. So think about getting some native grasses on your property, especially if you have rural land. And then if you have some already set aside, what we call old hay fields, leave them for the birds. And so that was our conservation tip last time, native grasses.
Now, in Florida, when I lived there, they had a concept called xeriscaping, which was essentially that, using the landscape that is natural to the area. But, of course, you know, sculpting it so that it has that human touch to it. Is that something that is possible in this area?
Yeah, and in Florida, you probably heard about the Kissimmee Prairie.
Right.
And that one is just really hanging on by a thread, because there are a lot of birds that are in that Kissimmee Prairie that they're really trying to keep alive and in sustainable numbers, but it's becoming so isolated and alone that it's very difficult to do, especially with these native grasslands that need prescribed fire. You have to then whittle up your existing prairie and not burn it all at once.
Right.
Because those critters need to go somewhere. So you kind of have to think of putting it and cutting it in thirds and burning in thirds, for example, or do a patchwork of burning. But yeah, the Kissimmee Prairie is unique. It's got a resident grasshopper sparrow over there. There's other grassland birds that are there that are just hanging on barely. And that's true here in Louisiana. The Cajun Prairie, as they call it, down towards Lafayette, between Lafayette and Beaumont. And then in all parts of Texas, there were big chunks of prairie land that you know, you might think you're seeing good grasslands, but it's not good for wildlife, certainly not good for quail, sparrows, and other native songbirds.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502 tonight with any questions about birds or the avian world. That's 800-552-8502. And Cliff, what is going to be our spotlight bird this month?
Yeah, we profile a different species every month, and this one is the brown-headed nuthatch. It's a tiny bird, smaller than a chickadee. It spends most of its day high in the canopy of mature pine trees. Its voice sounds something like a squeaky bath toy, as we'll hear now. They're noisy little guys, but yeah, think of a squeaky bath toy. That's what I think of when I hear this guy. And they're tough to see. As I mentioned, they're tiny and they're way up high. You know, 60 feet in the mature pines isn't unusual for them. They can be higher than that. We have three species of nuthatches in the Red River Radio listening area, and all of them are known for going head first down the trunk of a tree. And so they climb in a fashion we call hitching. So hitching's the correct term used for their climbing action up and down tree trunks and branches. We also use that term for woodpeckers. The brown-headed nuthatch hitches up and down tree trunks and limbs, preferably pines, rarely hardwoods, where it gleans the bark for insects hiding under rough bark. And when in season, these birds also eat pine seeds. And in winter, they'll sometimes come to seed feeders or soot feeders near your home. They live in family groups because it's a cooperative breeder. And this means that some young from previous breeding seasons stick around to help the parents raise young during future breeding seasons. In human terms, you might call this a multi-generational household. Nuthatches are cavity nesters. They carve their own nest hole, and the brown-headed does so often in a fire-blackened or wind-thrown pine stump. This means the nest is low, maybe 6 to 8 feet off the ground. It's in a dead, short-stature pine trunk that's still standing but clearly dead, what we call a snag. Nuthatches will also use man-made nest boxes or hollows in fence posts or telephone poles. This species thrives best up in the canopy of open pine forests managed with prescribed fire. What's best for them are stands of larger, older, and well-spaced pines. Young and densely stocked pine plantations just don't do the trick. This nuthatch is non-migratory. It occurs year-round in the southeastern U.S., barely reaching the Mason-Dixon line. There's a disjunct population of brown-headed nuthatches on Grand Bahama Island in the Caribbean, but unfortunately, they've almost been extirpated from there. This is one of a small handful of birds, what we call piney wood specialties, where birdwatchers living nearby in pine-free areas like Dallas, New Orleans, or San Antonio must travel here to the piney woods to see a brown-headed nuthatch. And for you to see one, we have a photo by James Childress of Lufkin on the Bird Calls webpage, so give it a look. It's a cute little bird.
And we have a strange sound here that we want to identify.
Wow. And that's that. This is, let me set the stage. So this is nighttime. This could be a neighborhood. This could be out in the country. And it's a screech or a scream. And a lot of times I get calls from people wondering what this bird is. And so we're bringing it to this episode to demonstrate. Here's more. There, it sounds like it's fighting, doesn't it? Like a bird caught something. But these are all foxes. These are the red fox. These are not a bird, obviously. But a lot of people think that it's an owl. They hear it at night, and they're wondering, you know, maybe it caught a cat, and the cat's screaming. But no, this is the first part you heard were the barks of the red fox, and the latter part you heard was begging. Baby red foxes beg a lot. And the last time this came up was an email that went around my department. Someone recorded that latter sound of the begging at a campground near Toledo Bend Reservoir on the Texas side. And of course, nobody knew what it was, and they thought, okay, well, let's send it to the bird guy. And I said, well, it's not a bird, but here it is. It's a red fox. And so it's good to know what's out there, because I think a lot of people hear strange noises and they want to think, you know, it's Bigfoot, chupacabra, something unusual. But this is the normal sound of a red fox. They're in our area, in our listening area. They're very widespread in North America. They've been introduced to most parts, and this is something you might hear in your neighborhood or out in the country at night.
Well, it also sounds very similar to me when I stub my toe in the middle of the night, too, just so you know. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. We've got four calls online, and we're going to go to Clyde from Nacogdoches. But Melissa, Pip, and Leon, please stay on hold. We'll get to you in just a moment. Clyde from Nacogdoches, you're online with Cliff. What's on your mind?
Well, I was hoping I'd be able to bring you a recording, but that didn't happen. But I have heard several times in the last few weeks a bird. It's up high above the intersection at Main and North Street. I go in there to grab me a cup of coffee, and I will sometimes hear this thing.
Okay.
And it's a single note. It sort of starts fairly loud and then shades down, and it's repeated, you know, four or five times, and then don't seem to hear it for, you know, until I hear it again.
Yeah.
And it's a... I've looked for it to see what it might be. I can't see anything that's making the noise up in the, you know, like sitting on a light pole or something like that. It's a you know, kind of a middle of the road sound. I mean, in terms of its note.
Yeah.
But it's quite loud. And it, you know, repeat four or five times, and then, you know, stops for a while.
Yeah.
Would you have any clue?
Well, of course, you're giving me some description, namely the surroundings help, that we're talking about pavement and buildings and lights, intersection lights, and so what I'm envisioning is possibly a European starling. And they'll often sit in those kind of settings and make their kind of their I don't even know what you call it, like a screeching whistle.
It's quite a pleasant sound.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the call is quite pleasant. It's just a single note, and it sounds like it's coming from up high.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't sound like it's you know.
It's not flying over or something.
It doesn't sound like.
Yeah.
No. It sounds like it's coming from a single place.
Yep. And they nest in little holes in anything, the side of a building, a drain pipe. And if you look at your intersection light, and if you're a bird watcher like me, you're sitting at that red light and you see a bird flying to the end of that pole that's holding up the red, yellow, green light, and it disappears. Well, that's the European starling. He found a cavity, a hole in there, and he's raising young in there. And so I often hear starlings in that setting that you've described. So I'm going to guess European starling, Clyde, and that's going to have to be my only option there, unless you get us a recording that we can find otherwise. But the problem with that intersection or any intersection, you got car noises and sirens, and it's just really going to be tough for you to do it. So
I understand.
Yeah. So I'm guessing European Starling, and that's probably what it is. So that's pretty cool, though. You're there in the cement jungle and still looking at birds.
I keep looking for something and not seeing anything, which aggravates me.
Yeah, they're not very large. They're about the size of a cowbird, which, you know, not a cattle egret, but a cowbird, smaller than a grackle, but dark. And when they sit on these posts, they're very dark. In the shadows. If you get one on the ground this time of the year, the adults are yellow-billed and iridescent with speckles. They're really pretty.
I've seen pictures of starlings.
And then they're spitting out young right now that I've seen in big flocks. I think the young of the year all hang out together, kind of like a pack of teenagers, but I'll see 20 and 30 at a time, and they don't have a yellow bill. They don't have the iridescence. They're flat gray, very clay, earth tone color to them, and same looking bird, just different colors. But that's just a young of the year starlings, and they love our cities. That is a bird that has done well, and we brought them here. As the name implies, European starling, they don't belong here. We brought them over here about a century ago.
And what's the difference between that and an English starling? Are they the same?
The English sparrow is also called the house sparrow, and he's quite different. And he's not very musical, has a black bib, but does nest in similar conditions. They're also cavity nesters, also like downtowns and heavy traffic areas like that. But their calls is quite a bit different. So I think Clyde had a European starling.
Okay, that works.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you read Nero Wolfe Mysteries?
No, I don't have time for that. What is that all about?
Well, Nero, in one of the Nero Wolfe books, he was quite a gourmand. And one of the books has a bit of byplay where Nero is having a dish of starlings.
Oh, okay. Well, cool. So they made it into the literature there. Good.
Oh, yes.
Yep.
Have a great day.
Okay.
Thank you so much for taking the call.
Great. Thanks, Clyde.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. By the way, there's also a band called Starling, Tennessee.
Too. What kind of music is that?
It's very interesting. It's got a bluegrass feel, but it's also got an alternative kind of pushy, kind of rocky feel to it, too. So
cool.
All right. We have Pip on line on hold and Leon on hold, but we're going to go to Melissa next from Gilmer, Texas. Melissa, you're on line with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
So I live in a neighborhood that has a lot of grass, a lot of manicured lawns, and I have what's called a wildlife habitat yard with the National Wildlife Federation that's certified.
Yep.
And I thought you might be familiar with that program, and you might want to share with others kind of what that entails and some of the things they could do to increase habitat for their yard.
Yep, and we often bring up wildscaping and native habitats and backyards on the show. We even did a conservation tip on that, promoting natives, promoting pollinator plants, and berry-giving plants, and not just planting what the big box stores sell. So things, you know, that aren't going to be recommended that we just love as a species. We love our crepe myrtles. We love our nandinas. But these don't provide a lick of good for wildlife. So instead, we recommend things like Turk's cap and lantana and buckeye and American beautyberry. And these are all pretty easy to grow, and they do well in our climate, and they give something back to wildlife, and they have the beauty, so they have the color, but they have a different mission as well, and that's the beauty. You're getting more bang for your buck. So we have at Parks and Wildlife a process that's similar to what the National Wildlife Federation has, and it's called, we have a what's called wildscaping, but it's the same thing. And that's great that you've got your certified, and I hope you have your sign proudly displayed on your fence. Is that right?
I have it proudly displayed, but my neighbors walk by and continually say, "Oh, that is an eyesore."
Yeah.
So, yes.
Yep.
I think the perception of what beauty is different from manicured lawn to actual wildlife habitat sometimes, and I think that's a struggle for some people.
It is. It's not for everybody. Just like restoring that old car might be beautiful to some and not for everybody. You know, I've seen a lot of really cool 1950s cars restored that I think are just fantastic. And most people are like, well, where are the cup holders? Where's the DVD player? And so it's not for them. And the same thing with wildscapes. And when we lived in Austin, my wife and I, it was our first home, our starter home. We were so excited. We bought it from a friend who started a wildscape on it, very well-established wildscape. Well, we decided to double it. And so we ripped out the grass and ripped out anything non-native, and the neighbors were watching because here we are, you know, back and forth with truckloads of mulch and wheelbarrows of this and that, and the most of the neighbors were like, well, you know, that's crazy. And like the attitude you mentioned, it's just not for everybody. But we did have one neighbor who thought it was cool, and she started doing a little bit. And I, you know, we moved 10 years ago from there, but I'm hoping that she made her wildscape a little larger and maybe influenced somebody else. So it's kind of like this show. I don't expect everybody to do these conservation tips, but if just a handful of people do, then maybe that's making a difference. And then those people can then go into their subdivision, their neighborhood, and maybe hit 10 different people. Maybe only one of them will do it. But I think that's how these things start. Don't they call that the grassroots method? No pun intended.
Literally.
Yeah. So we got to start at that kind of a level and hope for the best. And, you know, to be honest, I would do this. I would continue to do wildscaping. And it sounds like you would, too, despite what any neighbor says. You know, they can have their mowed lawns and their boring English-looking landscapes all they want, but I'd rather have stuff that's native to this area and not stuff that, you know, came from the Mediterranean or China or somewhere else exotic. To me, native is the way to go. So good for you, Melissa, for doing that.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yep.
Thank you, Melissa, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question about birds and our avian world is welcome. And we're going to go next to Crockett, Texas. And, Pip, you're on the line with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Hi, Bill. Hi, Cliff.
Hey, Pip.
How you doing?
Good.
I live over here in Crockett, and of course we're right in the pine woods, and of course it's a real mix of hardwood and you know, and pine trees.
Yep.
And they stocked turkey here years ago. Gosh, I don't know. They've tried it, I think, in the last 34 years or so that I've been back here full time. I think they've tried it at least twice, and it just doesn't seem to work. And I wonder, I've never figured out why. I wonder if you had a feeling on that.
I do, and I think, you know, it's all about habitat. Parks and Wildlife does what's called super stocking of wild turkey. They'll get turkey from other states where they are numerous or even a nuisance. They might be in a neighborhood setting where they're a problem, and or they're super numerous in some state. Can get rid of extras and let us come get them, and we pay for them and have to ship them down here. It's very laborious. But the big thing is we're not finding enough big landscapes for wild turkey. So that's, to me, the issue is that the habitat's just not right. It might be on a 10,000-acre property that one person owns and is doing everything right for wild turkeys, but wild turkey is an example of a bird that needs big landscapes, big real estate, and 10,000 acres isn't enough. So it's going to take lots of people with 10,000 acres to really get a big chunk of real estate ready for that bird, and they need uplands in the breeding season. They need bottomlands in the fall and the winter. It's a bird that needs big, giant landscapes. And so that's, I think, the problem. If you look at in your area in Crockett, we've got just too many pine plantations. It's just got one species of plant on it, loblolly. And that's just like pavement to a lot of birds. It's no different than a parking lot to a lot of birds, and wild turkey in particular. I mean, they'll run through it, but my gosh, they're not going to find one thing to eat in there. They're not going to have much safety and cover in there. So what they need is very different, and that kind of goes back to what we started with the episode on native grasses. That's the biggie. For part of the year for wild turkeys, they need native grasses that are pumping out grasshoppers, and that's what the poults are eating in the spring and the summer. And then in the winter, they're going in the bottoms. They're looking for mast, acorns, and other nuts, and they're competing now with non-native species like wild hogs that are going in there and eating the same things. White-tailed deer go in the bottoms as well to eat that stuff, and they're fine, they're native, but we got a lot more mouths to feed now with hogs, and we've talked about trying to get rid of or at least reduce the numbers of wild hogs, and this is one of the reasons why. If we want to have things like wild turkey to come back, we have to look at all these different problems. So it's wild hogs, it's non-native grasses, it's small parcels of land, and all these things add up to make it very difficult to reintroduce wild turkey.
Well, that answered that question.
Yeah, and I don't want to sound like a party pooper, okay? Because I think that we need to keep trying, and I have seen a definite increase in properties that are doing the right thing for wild turkeys, and if we can be strategic and work with the exact adjacent neighbors to these properties and build those acreages up and build them up and build them up, and then have, I'm talking about a third of a county. That's what I'm talking about, big landscapes. I'm talking about a third of a county, which I don't even know how many hundreds of thousands of acres that is, but it's a lot. And that's what we need for wild turkey. We can't do it on 10,000 acres.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's it.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot.
Okay, Pip, thanks for calling.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question concerning birds or our avian world are welcome. We're going to go next to Leon from Bossier. Leon, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
My question is the difference between the raven and the crow.
Okay.
And why we do not have ravens in our neck of the woods.
Yeah.
I've been in areas that had the raven, and it is a magnificent bird.
It sure is. And you've got to go north or west of this listening area to find ravens, and a good deal north and a good deal to the west. You've got to go west of I-35 into Texas. To get into true raven habitat where you're going to see them with great regularity. We have two species of crows in the listening area. We have the American crow and the fish crow. And the American crow has the typical caw, caw, and the fish crow has a very nasal call, like a ah. And I heard one today on my drive here right on the border of Texas, Louisiana, on my route on 79 between Bethany and Greenwood, right on the. I was in Louisiana, but just barely. I heard a fish crow on my pit stop there, and that's not a bird we have in Nacogdoches, the fish crow, but you can go to Caddo Lake, you have fish crows. You can go down towards I-10. In Louisiana, there's plenty of fish crows, but no ravens. And so, anyway, I'm wondering if you brought this up because there was a really cool national NPR episode or a commentary on ravens and crows just the last couple days.
Yeah.
Did that spark this, Leon?
No,
oh,
I did
okay.
not hear that.
Yeah, it was really cool. So you might go to the National NPR website and see if you can get a podcast of that. Or, Bill, maybe you know how to do that.
Just go to npr.org, and they'll have a search engine up there. So just put in the keywords raven and crows.
Yeah.
Why do we not have ravens in our neck of the woods?
Well, if you know, I think ravens are smart, because if you look where ravens occur, they're up high in the mountains where it's just nice and cool. And very easy to fly around when you're a big bird. You want to, it's nice to be cooler when you're big, and when you have big wingspan, it's easy to fly. But we just don't. And I think we have crows filling that niche. Those two species of crows filling the niche of corvids, dark corvids here in this area. And I think if I was a raven, actually we just went to Santa Cruz Island off the coast of California, and I fell in love with ravens again, just watching them flying on these rock bluffs and having this cool air all the time and these beautiful views all the time. And I think ravens, they're simple, one color bird, but they're just elegant, and I really love ravens. And that's one thing they talked about is their repertoire in that NPR episode, and there's a lot known about the vocalizations of ravens, but I just think that ravens have it made where they are, and they've never occurred here, and they probably never will.
Yep. Well, they're closely related to the crow.
They are. They are. They're a larger dark corvid. They're larger than any of our crows, and they've got a different shaped tail. They have more of a Roman nose of a bill or a beak, and but they're very similar. They're very omnivorous. They're very gregarious. They're intelligent. They usually can travel in groups and work together as a group. And they're just neat birds. I do wish we had ravens here, but we don't. But I sure love it when I go out west in the Rockies or go in the Northeast and see them. It's refreshing. Yeah.
I got turned on to them when we were traveling in Colorado.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, well then, to stay in love with ravens, Leon, you're going to have to do like me and travel. So that's the only way we're going to see them.
Thank you. I really enjoy the show.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Leon. And what's the difference with blackbirds and then magpies? Are they all part of that same?
No, magpies are in the same family as the raven and crow. So that includes magpies, jays. And then if you go into other parts of the world, there are tree pies and a whole bunch of other, there's ground jays. There's about 110 species or so of jays around the world. And I think it came up in that NPR piece that the black corvids, the crows and ravens, are on every continent except Antarctica and except for South America, which is pretty interesting. So,
interesting.
Yep. So they're everywhere else, but not, you can't find one in Brazil or Colombia.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now. We have lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Kenny and Paul, you are on hold for a few seconds. We're going to go next to Jeff and Henry from Benton, Louisiana. What's your question tonight?
Hi, good evening. Cliff, thanks for taking our call.
Yeah.
We live up on Cypress Lake in Benton, and we have a small gray hawk. And we think it's a hawk. Thought it was a sparrow hawk, but it doesn't appear to have any color except kind of a flat gray with a blackish-colored wing.
Go ahead.
Any idea what that would be?
Well, are they sitting a lot or are they flying a lot?
They seem to fly, circular on the wind currents. But we have a large oak tree in our backyard, and it does land in the oak tree, but doesn't stay for long. Right at the very tip top of the oak tree.
Okay, because there is a raptor with kind of narrow and pointy wings called a Mississippi kite, and he's all gray. And they're on the wing most of the time. The exception would be if in that oak tree you got a nest, and they're bringing food to feed the nestlings in that nest. There's also a small hawk that's fairly gray, and a little bit of brown and white called the broad-winged hawk. but they're not so showy and obvious, not like a Mississippi kite. So I'm going to guess that your bird's a Mississippi kite. So maybe when we're done with the call, go to your internet search and look for Mississippi kite and see if he matches. And there's not much color to him. Just kind of go by shape is the better way to do it, because you might see a photograph of one in bright light and you'll say, I don't see those colors. And when you see it, it's usually in the, you know, the lighting's not so good that you can't see all the any color that's on them. Like on the top of the wing, they have a little bit of white. I think it's in the secondaries, and you don't see that until they bank, and the lighting has to be just so, and it's just, if you're not paying attention, you'll miss that color. But Mississippi kites are very common. They make flight look super easy because they very rarely flap. They're using thermals, they're gliding around, and they're looking for dragonflies and other large insects. So if you see one flying around your neighborhood, you think, oh gosh, bring in the little dogs and the kitties. This guy has no interest in your pets. They have interest in cicadas and dragonflies and grasshoppers and other large insects that are flying around. Okay?
We've seen it in one high-speed, you know, dive, but couldn't see get near the ground.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I've seen it take that same move over the water a couple times.
Okay, then I think it is a kite, because I've seen them fold their wings as they probably see a dragonfly 50-100 meters away, and they'll fold their wings and just like a bullet go over there and get it. So I'm guessing you have a Mississippi kite.
Well, thanks very much. Great bird to watch. We appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, Jeff.
All right, you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And the phone lines are open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Paul from Nacogdoches, don't go anywhere. We'll be with you in just a few moments. We've got Kenny online next. Kenny from Shreveport, what's your question?
Good afternoon. I have an update on a prior call that I had made.
Okay.
And a question. I contacted you about a scarlet tanager that I had found in a residential street by the curb. You said get it to rehab as soon as possible.
Okay.
Which I did.
Good.
And she's a lady that lives over in the Centenary area. She's very nice. She rehabilitates all kinds of animals. And I stopped by when I was in the neighborhood a few weeks later, and she said that it had been released back into the wild, and I was happy to hear that.
All right. High five, Kenny.
Yeah, and then this lady, I was just very impressed with her.
Well, great. And that was one of our conservation tips. Let me think how many months ago that was. It was probably two or three episodes ago. We talked about, you know, everybody has the sheriff's number on their fridge and 911 on the fridge. Well, you always need to have your closest, nearest rehabilitator on your fridge too, because you never know when you're going to find something. And every minute you take looking on the internet, calling friends, calling agencies that are, you know, not going to pick up the phone because they're swamped, have that number at your fingertips. And that's good, because you never know when you're going to find another bird that's worth saving, and a scarlet tanager certainly is. So
a beautiful bird.
Yeah, good for you. Was that a male that was red?
It was a male.
Oh, even better. I hope you took pictures of him before you surrendered him to the rehabber.
You know what? I don't think quick like that. I should have. But he was stunned, and I think you were right that he had flown into a window.
Yeah.
And had a concussion. He was very docile. But she said that he perked up and wanted out, and that's when she knew he was okay.
Oh, good.
She released him into a park that has the high trees and birds that she said that they get along with, that had a lot of those birds. So
great.
It was just beautiful. I just looked up Louisiana birds until I found it.
Right.
Solid red with the black wing and the little black tail. Beautiful bird.
That's great, Kenny. And so what's really neat about the scarlet tanager, he's a migrant through the Shreveport area, doesn't winter or breed here, and so they winter in the tropics. So just think, that bird that you picked up could have spent the winter in Peru, for example, or Panama. It's just remarkable. And then the closest breeding we have is the Ouachita Mountains, which is just a hop and a skip from here, just into the Arkansas area. And so he was almost to the breeding grounds, but and then they continue. They go even farther north. Some breed in the Ouachita, some breed in the northern U.S. states. So Minnesota, Wisconsin, for example. So pretty cool that you saw that, and high five again, Kenny, for taking it to a rehabber and getting it fixed.
I was lucky because there was one in my neighborhood. They're not that many.
Yeah.
In the search that I made.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that... go ahead.
I had a question.
Okay.
Because I see most of this stuff when I'm riding my bicycle, which I do every day, and they were fogging for mosquitoes the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just going to get your take on that, because does that have any negative impact on the food that the birds eat?
Wow. You know, the mosquito problem is a modern man created problem.
Right.
You know, we've altered waterways. We create ditches for runoff, and then the water sits, and then we have all kinds of junk in our yards that collect rainwater, and the mosquitoes just love it. You know, historically there weren't these things that that made mosquitoes in these huge swarms like we have now. So we've done this, we've created it, and sadly going around spraying chemicals, I don't like it. I think there's non-targets, obviously. That are going to get killed. I think that you're also killing flying insects that other birds are eating that are beneficial.
Exactly.
And so, but we're going to get outnumbered by people that are sensationalized by words like Zika and West Nile virus. And just think of Zika, it's here, but gosh, just a few months ago, it was on the tip of everybody's tongue, and now you don't hear about it all that much.
Right.
It's not the flavor of the month anymore, and I don't want to make it sound like it's not a big deal. It is, but what I'm saying is, if we as a species did a little bit better job cleaning up after ourselves, you know, it's not just the floor in our bedroom that I keep getting my kids to clean up their floor and pick up after themselves. We need to do it as a whole everywhere we have influence around us, and so we're creating this mosquito problem.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah.
There's a tiny little mosquito, and I saw it in Austin, and people saying they'd never seen it before, and now I'm seeing it here. It's just a little tiny thing. It's a new species that has shown up. I certainly didn't know about when I was growing up.
There's a little one that gets in our house that even the fastest slap to try to kill them, it blows them out.
Exactly.
And we just, my wife and I just look at them going, well, I'm not even going to try to kill that one because I know what's going to happen.
Right.
So, and of course, we don't want to donate blood to that one, but what else are you going to do? So I am vigilant. I have to get up on my roof a lot to clean out my gutters because I know that when the leaves fall and I have certain species that'll drop leaves on my roof all year long, and then any little bit of water that collects there can be a breeding ground for mosquitoes. I don't have tires in my yard. Those are, you know, magnets for mosquitoes. We don't have pots, potted plant pots that hold water that just can be breeding grounds for mosquitoes. So I think if everybody cleaned up their room like when you're growing up and did that in your yard, we would be in a lot better place because you are at the mercy of your neighbors with mosquitoes. It's not just your yard. It's every house you can see from your yard. That mosquito can make it over there to you.
Exactly.
Yep. Okay, very good, Kenny. Well, thanks for the call, and keep up the good work with the tanagers.
I appreciate you very much.
Great.
All right, thank you, Kenny. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Rick from Shreveport, hang on for a second. We've got to go to Paul next from Nacogdoches. Paul, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, thank you very much. I used to go out to Powell Point, and that's around the Rayburn.
Yep.
And that was about 20 years ago.
Yep, I know.
I've been living here about 40 years.
Okay.
And I went to this little store, this Cajun store. I went in, got some juice and stuff. I came out. There was a raven sitting right there on a post. And I know what crows look like.
Yeah.
Crows are all around my house 24 hours a day. This was a raven.
Uh-huh.
And it was hairy. It had a big bill. It was bigger than a crow, and it was making a little warbling sound. And it was beautiful. It was a fabulous bird.
Right.
You know. And so they might not live here, but I think maybe occasionally they come through here.
Well, I know Powell Point. That's at the end of FM 705 on Sam Rayburn. I used to go down there a lot. There used to be a property that Stephen F. Austin's College of Forestry owned.
Oh, yeah, right. I go past there, yeah.
Yep, and they owned a property there for Field Station and other camps of various types. So I used to go down there a lot and teach elder hostel classes there at that site about 6 or 8 a year. And I never saw a raven, and we have no records of ravens in the Piney Woods of East Texas.
Well,
so I'm not going to argue with you. I'm just saying that's such a special bird. We need to have a photograph of it or a recording.
Well, I was actually, you know, shocked because the difference between a crow and a raven is pretty substantial.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, so I was looking at it. You know, this is not a crow. You know,
yeah.
It's bigger, and it had hair sticking out all over the place, and a big beak, and it was sort of hunched over. You know,
right, right.
And it was it had a real aura to it. You know,
right,
and,
right. Well,
and also, I know probably this is going to be totally off the wall, but about 10 years ago. I walked out of my house. I'm right on the lake. I heard a loon.
Uh-huh. That's not unusual. And Powell Point is a place where one time in loon migration, I counted, I want to say 70 common loons at one from that point. It was clearly staging from birds that were headed north. I remember it was in spring. And southerly birds were probably stopping there and taking a break. And at Powell Point, you have, I don't remember, 200-plus degrees of viewing at that little park, at that little Corps of Engineer Park. And so I couldn't believe how many common loons I saw in one scan down there.
I had no idea.
And so I have on occasion heard common loons calling on area lakes and reservoirs, so that's not far-fetched at all. For you to have heard
a loon. I wish we had more of them. That sound is incredible.
It is. Yeah. And we certainly don't have them calling all night long like up to the north in the breeding season. But occasionally they might be, you know, coughing and clearing their throat and getting ready and looking at their clock saying it's time to go to Wisconsin. I better start practicing. Because we do hear them, but very unusually, very rare. But no,
it's a totally northern sound, isn't it? I mean, it's totally... It's not. It really feels cold and northern.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's another smart bird that gets out of here in the listening area in the hot summer and goes up where, you know, we're wearing jackets at dawn and dusk, and if we have the windows open at night, we're needing blankets because it's so darn cool and refreshing. So loons leave our area. If you have a loon that over summers, it's going to be an injured bird or an old bird, but the rest of them get up and get out of here. So, but that's pretty cool. So, are you in the Powell Park area full time?
Well, I'm across the water. I'm about 5 miles east on 103 around Etoile.
Oh yeah, okay.
And so I'm like on that peninsula, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a great area to be living if you like birds, because you know how it is. Every day there's going to be something different flying through your area.
Yeah.
So good. Keep your eyes out for birds, Paul, and take pictures if you get another raven. Okay.
Yeah, I'm really glad that this whole area. I mean, maybe it's affected by chemicals and everything, but I really feel like when I walk out the door in the morning, I see so much wildlife, and the frogs are healthy and.
Yep.
Everything's really really healthy.
And things are good right now. You remember what Rayburn looked like back in the drought in what 2011?
Right.
When it looked like a ghost town, and the water was so low, you could see all the stumps that weren't peeking up anymore. You could see them, and it was bizarre looking. It looked like the apocalypse.
What I don't understand is all the weeds survived the drought, but these giant oaks didn't.
And that dirt that hasn't seen daylight maybe a couple times since 1965 when they built that reservoir, that dirt you're talking about, it is amazing that seeds found it and grasses and weeds grew 6 foot tall in no time. It is amazing. I thought about that too.
I wish I had a cow.
Yeah. Great. Hey, thanks for the call, Paul.
All right.
Well, see you later.
Thank you for helping me out. Thank you.
Yep.
You bet. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have time maybe for one or two more calls. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. We have Rick from Shreveport who sent us that woodpecker video, Cliff, that we had just seen before the show, and he's online right now.
Oh, good. Rick, hey,
Rick, how are you?
Doing good, thank you. That was actually a video that my children took in our backyard.
And that's a bird that doesn't occur here in June or July, so I'm guessing they filmed it maybe in the winter or the spring?
Yeah, it was wild.
Yeah, because that bird, first of all, that's a yellow-bellied sapsucker. Okay, he's a woodpecker, and he doesn't stay here. They start leaving in April, and a few linger into May, but, man, that's another smart bird like common loon. They get out of here when it gets hot. So, but that's a yellow-bellied sapsucker, and you sent the video. I saw it about 10 minutes before we went on air. And if you're able to touch a bird like that, he's stunned. I'm guessing he hit a window. And so that would be a bird, I know it's past tense, but if that happens again, that would be a bird you'd want to go to your refrigerator and look for that number that I mentioned a little while ago that everybody should have their closest rehabilitator on their refrigerator and talk to that rehabber and get that bird some help.
Well, evidently, he recovered and flew away. So.
Okay. Well, then he probably hit his head, got a little bit of a headache, and recovered and got away. So that's a good one. That's a good thing that happened, that he got away and he's happy and healthy. So hopefully he migrated up north, maybe up to the Appalachians somewhere where they're breeding and is doing well. So. But that's a bird we get. They start showing up in September, October, and they'll spend the winter with us. And they're the ones that make the sap wells in our backyards that look like rows of bullet holes. It looks like someone took a Tommy gun and went and made 10 or 20 holes along the tree in a perfect horizontal line. Those are sapsuckers. They do that, and they come back, and they eat the sap, and they also eat any bugs that are caught in the sap. So it's pretty neat. And then some sapsuckers will even make larger sap wells that are square, rectangular in shape. They can be the size of a half dollar or a quarter, and they get a lot more sap off of those. So you'll see the sapsuckers work more than you see the bird sometimes.
All right. Thank you, Rick, for calling in. We've got one more call that we have to get to. Doug from Marshall, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hey, Cliff, I've called a couple of times, and I have an eagle's nest up here north of Marshall, and looked like year before last they had two babies, and I'm not sure what happened last year, but this year they had one baby.
Okay.
Well, now I'm seeing the two juveniles, and the one juvenile has just a tiny bit of white on the wings.
Okay.
And mom and dad are still around, or are they probably all still living in the same nest?
You could have, if you see some with a little bit of white, do you think you could have last year's birds maybe still coming to the area? So I don't know if you've got multiple generations that, you know, those young from previous years are not going to help the adults. Mm-hmm. They're actually, sometimes they'll even try, getting some scraps from mom and dad, but usually by then they're fending for themselves. And it
right.
takes them about 5 years to get that all white head and tail. But before that, it's pretty difficult to age bald eagles. So, but it
right.
sounds like you knew there was only one eaglet in the nest, and if you saw a point where there were two young, then probably, you know, there's also multiple nesting pairs around. So it could
right.
have been two hatchlings from two different nests. But what water body are we talking about? Are we talking about Caddo Lake?
No, we're on a private 65-acre lake
okay.
just north of Marshall.
And the nest is visible on the edge of that lake?
From the water, yes.
Oh, cool. That's cool. Yeah, that's neat. That's a bird that in Texas we had about seven nests in the 70s, and now we've got probably 300 or more across Texas.
Wow.
So that's pretty good success. Yep.
Well, I noticed. I looked back, and the first year we got pictures of this eagle was in 2008.
Uh-huh.
And they've been residing in the same nest ever since.
Yeah, they'll keep coming back. So, cool. Keep an eye on your eagles, Doug, and thanks for the call.
All right. And thanks, everybody, for calling in tonight. We've got to get to our conservation moment. And, Cliff, what have you got for us this month?
So, the conservation tip tonight is to let saw timber-sized trees live. And I'll explain. Here we go. So, wood products from timber are one of the top industries here in the Red River Radio listening area and in many forested parts of the country. Harvesting trees can be profitable, and as a result, short rotation plantings now dominate to generate revenue more quickly. Short rotation means trees aren't allowed to reach their maximum size and potential. We often forget that certain birds and other wildlife live in forests dominated with the larger, older age class of trees we often refer to as saw timber. Saw timber trees have large diameter trunks, and when you leave them in the forest, you can provide homes for lots of species of birds, mammals, and other wildlife. So delaying a timber harvest to let saw timber grow larger can maximize your profits when you do harvest and will prolong homes for even more wildlife. The brown-headed nuthatch, which we profiled earlier in this episode, thrives in forests of saw timber-sized pines. The more we can keep smaller stands of remote saw timber connected to other remote stands via forested corridors, the better. Bigger is always better, not just when selling timber, but also when leaving timber for birds and other wildlife and removing carbon from our air. Consider raising your rural forest like a community of humans with a varied age class from toddlers to senior citizens. In many of our forests, it's the senior citizen age class that's lacking, yet that's often the most productive for certain birds and other wildlife. So if you have a commercial timber operation or even just a small stand of trees to harvest on your property, consider delaying harvest or even leaving some of the more senior and stately trees that we call saw timber. Do it for the birds.
All right. And you have been listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, tonight. He is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We definitely want to thank those folks for loaning this man out to us each and every month. And yes, I said each and every month because beginning in September, on September 12th, Bird Calls will become a monthly show on the second Tuesday of every month. So you can look forward to some more interaction with Cliff and some more bird sounds all over the radio waves. Bird Calls is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of Louisiana. Again, I want to thank Cliff for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Bill.
Tune in on August 15th for the next edition of What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden. Bird Calls is produced by Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford with help tonight from Wally Derleth, Renee Moran, Henry Edwards, and Tim Schnell. The audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website in the next few hours, and then you can listen to that program again at redriverradio.org. And remember, if you have a photo or sound clip of a bird and you'd like Cliff to identify it, just send it to us at wbeckett@lsus.edu. This is Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public radio service from LSUS. This is KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Magnolia, and KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches. You can listen to us online around the world at redriverradio.org. Stay tuned. We have Radio Lab coming up next here on Red River Radio, And we hope you'll stay tuned for the rest of the evening's program with Wally Derleth and the Acoustic Hour at 8 o'clock and then Evening Jazz tonight at 9.